Hello, everybody, and welcome back to another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell, and this is my third and last program from the great state of Oklahoma. And before I introduce today's guest, I've got to say, when I drove into Oklahoma, the first big billboard that I saw said Foundation Recoveries. And I realized that I was in the hotspot of earthquakes in this country at the moment. And so today we're going to be talking to someone that has some knowledge on these. He's a geologist. His name is Todd Hallahan. And he's going to be talking to us about his career, his interest in the stability of the underground portions of Oklahoma. So, Todd, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you.
Before we get into earthquakes and hydraulic fracturing and all the other contentious issues that come along with this topic, let's talk a little bit about Todd. How did you become a scientist? What were those formative years?
Well, I used to get in fights with my high school physics teacher, and I didn't want to take physics because that was supposed to be the hard class. But then she was a biologist and teaching physics, which is pretty common, and I would disagree with her. Then it ended up going to college, and I didn't want to do physics because that was a hard major to do and was going to be an engineer. But then I figured out I disagreed with people. And there's some old saying of science is a belief in the ignorance of experts. And so when you don't agree with the experts, you're supposed to become a scientist.
Hey, I've not heard that, but I rather like it, I must say. And so it was, what did you study, physics or engineering?
So I studied physics as an undergrad. Yeah. I was on an engineering program and switched over to just straight physics and math and computer science, and went off onto internships to find out what I wanted to do in life, and went to internship. I said, well, I didn't want to do that. And went to the next internship, said, well, I don't want to do that either. So I ended up going off to the Bahamas because the geologists were trying to recruit me because the other geologists couldn't do math, and they thought having somebody who could do math hang out with them would help. And so they dragged me down to the Bahamas, and I decided that was pretty good. And so after I got my undergraduate degree, I went to the Bahamas for a year, and I was a physicist in a geologist robe.
And doing what in the Bahamas, apart from just swimming and you know?
I was teaching students about fish and coral reefs and the geology down there, but I was also the boat mechanic, the plumber, the electrician, the truck mechanic, and anything else that needed to be done, because I had a sort of an engineering background of working on cars and trucks and things.
Ah, the real American story. Growing up in England, we always thought that every American about 18 knew how to do everything on a motor car engine, you know, and they did, but no longer, in fact. That's a lost art, I suspect.
We always thought that, you know, in our high school, the students that weren't doing as well were shipped out to work on cars. And so we thought, well, we're supposed to be the better students. If they can do this, we can do it too. And so we would try, and we'd take apart the cars, and we'd hope to get them back together. And sometimes we did. Sometimes we'd go to the mechanic to get it fixed back up again.
So anyway, physics was where it started, and geophysics presumably then, or is where it evolved into your career?
I went into hydrology, and it came out of my wife was a radiochemist and was interviewing at her school to do her next degree. And I asked them if they had a geology program at the campus. That's how much I investigated it. And they had a program, and for the first time in many, many years, they did not have enough people to TA in the fall. I had a couple of geology classes, and they brought me in. Wow. So that's how I became a geologist, was one day in Columbia, Missouri. They were short of people.
And from the beginning of going to college to begin with all these variations on a theme, how long was it before you understood that, now, I'm a geologist?
I had to go to field camp. You don't get your badge as a geologist unless you go to field camp and spend 5 or 6 weeks out in the mountains somewhere. Until that point, you're just a physicist taking geology class.
Where did you go? Where was your field trip?
We went out to Lander, Wyoming, up in the Poposia River, and wandered around for 6 weeks out in western Wyoming.
And what were you looking for?
Learning to map rocks and learning to see what the topography looks like and how the rocks intersect and how to read the rocks. But then I became a hydrologist and had to learn the same things for water chemistry and water flow and how to read those in the context of the rocks.
Where did you go to graduate school and when?
I went to the University of Missouri to do my master's and got into hydrogeology doing canoeing through a cave in Columbia, Missouri.
Oh, very exciting.
And then I went off to the University of Texas, and while I was there, I shipped off to Australia and learned a lot from the Texans and the Australians, and did work there.
So let's jump to the feature. When I came across the state line, I saw this big advert, as I said earlier, to look after your foundations. We'll the implication is this is a growth industry, right? That foundations of homes and buildings across the state are being wobbled a little bit, let's put it that way, by a subterranean movement of the earth. Talk about this.
So it's interesting. In Oklahoma, the reason we have all the foundation repair companies is because we have shrink swell soils. And the soils with the very hot conditions in Oklahoma and the winters going on, the soils underneath the roads and the houses and the bridges shrink and swell and break them up. And so we need all these companies to come around and put the foundations back together.
Okay, so that's not what I immediately jumped to, thinking right. It was all to do with earthquakes and things. This is just the nature of the soil in this part of the world.
Right. This is why we have problems. And you can take a soil map and drive down the road, and as soon as you hit that contact with that shrink swell soil, you watch the road start to be cracked up, and then you get off that soil and things are good again. So it's a real problem on all the buildings around here. The earthquakes also added to that. The interesting on the earthquakes is in terms of thinking about as a state, there's a study that somebody was doing. They said, if you felt them, you knew it was a problem. If you didn't feel them, you didn't think it was a problem. And
oh, absolutely.
So it was a very, very localized problem for people that were getting shaken.
On my cell phone, I've got an app that tells me about the weather and what it's going to be like, what the temperature is, but there's a little subsection to put on earthquakes. And when I put it onto earthquakes, Oklahoma just goes woof. But they're all low level.
Well, and the number actually has been misleading to folks, because we've got a lot of fours, and folks in California say, oh, well, fours aren't anything interesting. But we don't have the attenuation that California has. So the surface reaction, which aside from the Richter scale, we have the Mercalli scale, which is what did you feel? And our fours feel almost like a California 5.
So talk about attenuation. What are you talking about there?
So as you generate the wave, how fast does that wave go away? And so how far away does somebody have to be to not notice that there was an earthquake? And so we talk about felt seismicity versus seismicity that was measured by a seismograph. And the felt seismicity is, hey, somebody noticed at the surface.
So it's like a heat index for temperature.
Right.
Okay, I mean, it's not just what the document is on the machine, but how you feel it as an individual.
Right. So if you have a earthquake happen 10 kilometers down and it comes up to the surface, and you have one at 3 kilometers, well, it's a lot closer to you, so you notice a lot more. And so our earthquakes were doing a lot more damage and were a lot higher sensation at the surface for the same number as something in California.
Because they are more shallow, is that what you imply? Or because also of the underlying geology of the soil and the rock base?
Right. It's both. It's the depth and the geology that we have.
Right.
And so those different factors go into what we call attenuation. How well does a wave go away when it's coming up towards you? And for our shallow earthquakes, they're pretty exciting. And for some folks, not necessarily in a good way.
Well, so tell me, why is there not then this common knowledge out there amongst the public? I mean, we know the Richter scale, we look 2, 3, 4, 5, and we've got a history. But now you're telling me that there's this other scale, which is, like, as I said, the heat index or the wind chill factor or something like that. Why is that not reported? And why is that not better known?
People have talked for a long time as to what's the best way to communicate an earthquake, and people know the Richter scale. And so we use that one, but people have debated whether that's the right one to use.
Is there a move in geologic circles to correct this and make it the Richter plus scale or something?
People have tried various scales, and you'll sometimes see the other ones represented. I find it's better to talk about what people actually felt. And did they feel their house shaking? Did they see stuff falling over? For the modern age, people were looking for videos and they wanted to see the earthquakes. And so being hit by earthquakes that were shaking people 6 times a day wasn't very interesting until you could see a video of things falling off of shelves and things. But the problem here was more of how often it was happening. And so not a lot of them were large, but having earthquakes hitting your house 6 times a day where you notice it, the house is shaking, it makes big creaking noises, it sounds like cars are hitting the house. That's pretty disconcerting to people.
This must have an impact upon economics. I mean, if you're living in a house that's getting shaken, you say 6 times a day, it doesn't matter. Once a month is enough for some people. That must have an impact on the value of that house, the resale value. And does that cause economic hardships? I mean, forget the actual damage. I mean, okay, a plate breaks here or a pot of tea gets spilled or something. But economics? Is there an impact that you can measure in Oklahoma, in this area?
The Oklahoma story is really interesting because the economics is that a lot of people work for oil and gas.
Right.
People are also getting shaken. And I don't talk to many people that say, hey, we want to shut down oil and gas. They just don't want the earthquakes to stop. And then people worry about the price of their homes and these sorts of things. But the interesting part was, in terms of talking about it, people felt like the only answer was you had to shut off production or keep the earthquakes. And that was the only two choices. And they didn't understand there was a middle road of measuring things and using science to improve the process. It's like saying, hey, you know, we've started flying planes and they crash a lot. Well, I guess that's how airlines will be. And we said, you know, we should do this more safely. And we invented parts of processes to make that whole process better. And now flying is a pretty safe deal. And it's, I think it's one of the big problems in the energy industry is the airlines developed the NTSB as a social culture piece. And the oil industry doesn't have that. And I think that hurts them a lot because when a plane crashes, you know, if it was a Boeing plane, having somebody come out from Boeing, you know they're liable and they're dealing with that. And they've got money involved and they've got liability and court cases coming up. Having them talk about that they're going to do things right and investigate it, you're always suspicious.
Okay. So we've really jumped right into the middle of this thing. Let's go back one step and explain to the listeners and myself the actual process that is taking place, why we are having these relatively shallow earthquakes because of the fracturing process. What is it that's actually being done that's causing these earthquakes?
So a lot of people think it's hydraulic fracturing, and they say, well, it's fracking earthquakes and things like that. And you can, when you fracture rock, you do make earthquakes because an earthquake is anytime you shake anything. So if you put a Coke can down, you made a little earthquake. You just made a really, really tiny one. If you go right. walking down the hall, you're making little earthquakes. So if you crack rock at depth, you're going to make little tiny earthquakes. But these earthquakes were largely derived from produced water being injected into the earth, into places that are close to faults that would like to move. And that was done for a couple of reasons. One is production water or produced water. When you're pumping an oil well, you're normally actually pumping a water well that has some oil. So when the water comes out, you're not wanting to use that. So you got to find something to do with it. If it's not drinkable and you can't use it for other things, you inject it. And they did that for a long time to protect surface water around this area. The other one was we were doing dewatering, which is we want to drop the water pressure in a reservoir and be able to produce more oil that way. And so we were just pumping it to reduce the pressure on the water. And those caused really large volumes to be injected into the subsurface. And we got to levels where we were starting to induce seismicity.
And I mean, the reinjection, from one point of view, it makes sense because the alternative is you just let it evaporate. The water is a one-time of utilization. So, I mean, there's no alternative but to re-inject the water back into the subsurface. It's a question of where, how deep, whereabouts. Explain that a little bit.
So the water side of petroleum wasn't studied very much. People, water side was always free. Finding water to produce oil, getting rid of water that you produce, that was all so low priced that nobody in the oil industry worried about it. Now there's worries about that. So petroleum water management and what to do with finding water when you need to make the wells or getting rid of the water when you produce it, that's become a thing because it's actually part of the bottom line now. And if you ignore it, you ignore it at your own peril and may go out of business. So what you have to do is watch what your options are. One option is injection. Other options are to find ways to recycle the water. And that's usually in places where the water that's coming out is of higher quality. Our water is really low quality. It's near halite saturation, or it's saturated with salts.
Right.
And it's 100,000 to 300,000 parts per million. I mean, it's way up there in terms of sort of concentrations. You can walk on this stuff. So the injection.
Well, as a matter of parallel, what is the Black Sea?
Typical ocean water is about 35,000 parts per million.
Right.
When you get to some of these surface water bodies around the world, they'll get up around 100,000.
We got to take a break here. My name's Keith Pannell. You're listening to Science Studio. And our guest today is Todd Hallahan from the School of Geology at Oklahoma State University. We'll be back in one moment.
Welcome to Medical Discovery News. I'm Dr. Norbert Herzog.
And I'm Dr. David Niesel. Even though Americans are living longer than ever, not all of us are, because where you live can actually influence your lifespan.
If you were born in 2014, a recent report suggests your life expectancy will be 79 years. This is up 6 years from 1980 and a huge improvement from 1950 when people could expect to live to age 68.
But not everyone is benefiting. Consider that if you live in Oglala, Dakota County, South Dakota, you can expect a lifespan of just 66 years.
Shorter lifespans are also found in western Mississippi, parts of Alabama, north and south Dakota, eastern Kentucky, and western West Virginia. Native American territories in the Dakotas may have the shortest lifespans.
But if you live in central Colorado, you are in the epicenter of living long, 86 years. The same is found in certain counties of Alaska, New York, Florida, and Virginia.
So what explains these differences? First, socioeconomic factors play a major role, such as race, education, and income. Access to health care also. However, this study emphasizes that three-quarters of the factors that influence longevity are also classified as behavioral and metabolic.
What does this mean? They're controllable. Leading the list are obesity, tobacco and alcohol use, lack of exercise, high blood pressure, and diabetes. Drug addiction is a factor as well.
So the good news is you do not have to move to Colorado to have a long life. With the right choices and a little luck, you too can join the Longevity Club.
We are Drs. David Neisel and Norbert Herzog at the University of Texas Medical Branch and the Frank H. Netter School of Medicine at Quinnipiac University, where biomedical discovery shaped the future of medicine. For much more and our disclaimer, go to medicaldiscoverynews.com.
Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pennell, Todd Hallahan from the School of Geology at Oklahoma State University. And you were talking about this business that we need the water because you have to inject the water to facilitate some of the fracturing of the subsurface. I mean, that therefore releasing the petroleum. But then that has to come back out, all right? And it's that coming back out that has to be dealt with somewhere. Next week, I think, I'm going to somewhere in West Texas where they are using brackish water, let's put it that way, for growing algae, for example. So there are ways that you can utilize this water, but it won't be by pushing it back down. But is there any work like that going on here in the Oklahoma region?
So it's very dependent on what the water is coming out of your oil fields. And so if you've got cleaner water or if you've got combinations where you have excess energy available to do some things that change the finances of it, it's all in how much it costs per barrel to treat the water. And so when you look at your options, if you come up with something like 50 cents a barrel and you've got 10 barrels of water to deal with for every barrel of oil you get out, that's $5 a cost, and you can make that work. If you said, well, I've got an option, but it's $5 a barrel, well, now it's $50 to deal with the water you've got to do, and you're getting $50 per barrel for the oil. Right. Well, now you can't make that work. And so it very much comes down to what kind of water do you have and how much does it cost per barrel to deal with it.
Can you know that before you actually start going down to try to open up a source of hydrocarbon?
Yeah, and then when you go to open up a source of hydrocarbon, you're worried about, are we going to get gas? Are we going to get petroleum? What kind is it going to be? Is it going to be sour gas? What are these issues for our production? Same thing on the water side. What's the chemistry going to get? What kind of problems are going to get due to that chemistry? And what kind of flow rates are we expecting? And what can we do about that? But it's something that the petroleum industry typically hasn't had to worry about. The water side was, it was so cheap that we didn't have to be worried about the details. Now we've got to worry about those details.
Do you find in your experience that the industrial people involved in the discovery and recovery of petroleum products are taking it now very seriously? And do you find they were happy to collaborate with the scientists who can help solve some of the issues?
If you're in a $50 oil where you're just making it in terms of how much it's costing to produce and how much you're getting for it, saving on the water side can be one of the most profitable places you can look. So really understanding that science has really come up in the last few years. And there's now consultants out there and companies that are having water groups as part of their oil company so that they can do a lot better job on that water management side.
So on the other hand, if you're getting more than the $50 or if you're getting it by just putting a hole in the ground and up comes this stuff like in Giant and all the rest of it, then those people aren't quite so interested.
Well, so that's the cultural part of oil, and that's the wildcatter issue of we're going to go out and we're going to make money. And there was Backyard Oil Barons was a cable TV show where, hey, we own a drill rig and we have no idea what we're doing, but we're going to go drill around and make money.
Yes.
And they may know what they're doing, but in terms of the way it's presented is you're going to go out and find gold, you're going to find black gold, and you really don't have to have any technical background. It's kind of the presentation of the cable.
So, I mean, your feeling is that we're at this sort of growing up stage for the industry?
Well, it's not necessarily growing up. They've already grown
evolution,
up in the companies,
put it that
but
way.
It's putting in the social mechanism saying it's okay for somebody to talk about my safety issues that's going to investigate it and talk about it, but from a neutral perspective.
That would suggest perhaps that the very big companies out there doing exploration, you know, the Shells, the BPs, these people are much more amenable to inviting in the scientific community to really understand what they're doing with water in particular, whereas before they didn't, whereas the smaller entrepreneur is going to still be somewhat resistant.
I think it's mixed across the board that some of the large companies are more resistant to it. They're trying to work safely, but they're not sure they want somebody to look at what they're doing. And then some of the small guys are very technically adept and they're very conscientious of their safety stuff. So it's not just big and small. It's sort of a cultural thing of, are you okay with this structure of having somebody watching to make sure the safety is maintained at a high standard?
I've got a colleague, his name is Zach Hildenbrand, who's published quite a few papers on the quality of subterranean water before hydraulic fracturing, during and subsequent. And, you know, he goes out of the field and sometimes he gets met by people with weapons saying, you're not coming on my ground, lad. And others just open him with, welcome him with open arms. And in fact, even, you know, put money into getting results because they want to do it correctly. What's your role in this? Do you interact with the industry itself, or are you really in the ivory tower, you know, doing analysis, doing understanding, but don't actually have to deal with the business end of it?
As a professor, I've come up with intellectual property that is used by a company, so I've got a managed conflict of interest in my academic life where I've got a commercial side and an academic side.
Okay.
And I maintain all that kind of activity.
So what's the intellectual property? What does it do? What's your little gizmo?
My little gizmo is looking around for gasoline and solvents under the subsurface and getting them to show up in a geophysical data set.
So you, in fact, can do seismic studies and say that the water does or does not contain a high level of hydrocarbon? Is that what I just understood?
It's an electrical method, but I can tell you that it looks like there's a tumor there and we should biopsy it. So I can't guarantee you that you got cancer, but I could tell you that you got something that looks pretty funny and it has the electrical signal associated with gasoline. Let's biopsy it and determine if that's where it got to.
Okay, that's one aspect of the water, but the right. Other one is the materials that people put into the water that goes down there to loosen up, right, these sort of detergents and all sorts of other magic additives, all from chemistry laboratories, I hasten to admit. But, I mean, do you do analysis of this also?
Yeah, and on the oil side, people go, oh, there's all these chemicals they added. The one thing that controls it is economics. And so you can't add very much and still make money. So you're adding enough.
Or you've got to add things that are cheap.
You got to add things that are cheap or you can't produce. And so it's thinking about things like, if microbes start growing in your well, they'll clog it all up. So you want to do something to control them and control scaling issues and things.
Right.
You may have places elsewhere that your system will clog up. And so you want to think about what chemistry is going on and maybe particular ions that are a problem. And so working on all that side, the oil companies are worried about that tremendously. And they'll find out that the guy in the next lease over is really having problems. And they go, what's the science behind that? And can we fix it? And do a better job than he's doing.
Do you get much negative feedback to your career?
So on the earthquake side, I've tried to play the role, and the best I can describe it as a scientific referee, and provide the information that people need. And I don't tell people what they're going to do with the information. I don't tell them here's the right thing for Oklahoma or the wrong thing. Oklahoma has to make that decision amongst its people and its representatives. But I also don't want people deriving their own science because it fits their need. So I've done talks where they thought I was going to be more environmental, and I've done talks where they thought I'd be more oil-based, and I've done talks where they accused me of being overly neutral.
Well, it depends on the audience. I'm hoping that the talk is the same in all three places.
Well, I start the talk by saying, look, my goal is to be neutral, and that really does help. And I tell people, you know, I'm not trying to tell you, I'll tell you what your options are, and I'll tell you if a piece of science is true or not, and I'll tell you what the reference is to it. And so I had people that are you know, doing all sorts of different kinds of jobs, but they're interested in the topic, and they're reading geology papers, and they're coming to my next talk and saying, I read this paper, can you tell me what this means? Because I don't have the geology background, and I would walk them through the paper and tell them what it all meant. And so I have, the state of Oklahoma has a high level of understanding of induced seismicity.
Well, I bet they do. I mean, they're living it, in fact, right?
Right.
One final thought here. People talk about petroleum reserves, and do you know anything about the petroleum reserves, or that means gas and liquid, of Oklahoma? Is this an infinite? Well, it's not, but just say it for me. It's not an infinite supply of material. But what are the latest estimates for at the current rate of extraction that this resource in Oklahoma will exist?
It depends on technology and it depends on the price of oil. So,
because before hydraulic fracturing came along, you know, it was like diminishing resource. And then along came the new, and then all these pipes that go horizontal to the vertical. It's incredible. But given the modern, where we are today,
well, you know, if you said, hey, we're going to just do the exact same thing for the next 1,000 years, no, you're not. So, you know, and I've seen estimates, and it depends on whether you're a pessimist or optimist and what you think about the technology, but, you know, it's something like on the 100-year time scale. And that varies based on the price people are willing to pay.
Ah, well, that's true, too.
And so I saw somebody estimate.
America, I think I paid 29 cents for a gallon of petrol, gasoline. Now, then it got up to one, and that seemed to be like, oh, no one was going to pay more than $1 a gallon. Now it's what, three or something like that for a super or whatever. So it's,
And I saw somebody say, well, the future of oil, it's going to be $10 oil because of all the new technologies. But what they don't understand is if it was $10, you couldn't produce it for that. Nobody's going to produce oil. And so it's a relationship between the producers and the market. So the market, it costs you roughly $40 to $60 per barrel of oil to produce. That's the price it's going to be if it's low. It'll go below that because of market forces, but people are losing money, so that won't go forever at that price.
That's right. And technology, thank goodness, is producing all sorts of new materials for solar-powered energy, electric cars, self-driving cars. You know, we're in a bit of a revolutionary period. And there are people who think that maybe in 30 years we just will be using so much petroleum products for combustion.
The other interesting thing is social. So when you look at nuclear or oil, both of those have a real bad connotation, solar and wind are really good, but all of them have their environmental pluses and their environmental minuses. And so when I give talks about that in my classes, people think I'm somehow non-environmental or something if I say that there's some bad sides to solar or wind. Then here's the things, the positives, here's the negatives, here's the prices. You look at that stuff, it's funny, the social side of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think people have done some sort of estimates on one solar set of panels for a house. I mean, it looks like, oh, you paid $11,000 or something, and it was so clean. But when you work backwards, all the energy that was put into that, which all came from oil and gas, it's fascinating.
Or the mining of the materials to make it and all those sorts of things.
Hey, we could talk on forever. We only had 28 minutes. I think we've already used 32. So, Lauren Terrasis, I thank you for putting this program together because you're going to have a lot of editing to do. I'd like to thank Kelly Burley of the radio station KOSU here in Stillwater, Oklahoma, at Oklahoma State University for helping me and using their studios, and you, the listener, but in particular, Todd, again, thank you so much for being here on Science Studio.
Thanks for having me.
It's been great fun. And I'd like to thank the listeners out there. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.